You're listening to Stephen Maggi, host of one of America's top interview programs, The Stephen Maggi Show.
Hi, thanks for joining me today. I'm Stephen Maggi. Later in the program, you will meet a very important person in the history of rock and roll, Glenn Johns, a member of the Hall of Fame who has worked with the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, and many more. Still later, you'll meet a man who was a key figure in the Watergate hearings that brought down then-President Richard Nixon. John Dean is with us today. But up first, a man who answers questions that have puzzled crime experts for decades. Everybody seems to love the great movies about the mob and so forth. Everybody thinks of The Godfather, maybe the greatest movie of all time, Goodfellas, Donnie Brasco, and all that. We got another one coming out based off a book written by our guest, Charles Brandt, regarding the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa and things like that, which everybody's fascinated by. The book is I Heard You Paint Houses, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and Closing the Case on Jimmy Hoffa. And his name is Charles Brandt. Charles, welcome to the show. Gotta ask you, do people always kind of roll their eyes when they hear about your concept of Jimmy Hoffa? Because for so long we've been teased by that nobody really knows what happened to him.
Well, yes, that's a good question. In the beginning, we were the victim of all the bad books out on Hoffa, and it took a while to get a publisher. But once we got the wonderful company we're with now, Steerforth, they went out of their way to make sure that the public understood that this was the real McCoy, which of course it is. So,
well, yeah, I think people are fascinated by it because the Jimmy Hoffa thing has been legend. You know, and you also talk, anybody that was around in the 1960s and 50s, they remember all that with the Kennedys and so forth. And you even talk about that. In your book, you also talk about information about what happened there. That was all intertwined, right, at that time, the mob connections and really the government at that time and so forth, and they're battling each other and what have you.
It was all entwined. Bobby Kennedy, the president's kid brother, was the attorney general, and he was the sworn enemy of the mafia. And the mafia became then a sworn enemy of the Kennedys. They didn't want to be put out of business by the kid brother. And they believed that the way to do it was not to kill the kid brother, because then the president would only seek greater revenge. But to kill the president, it's an old Sicilian expression that when you cut a dog's head off, the tail dies too. So that's all entwined in this book. The new edition of the book, for those people who have read the prior edition, just came out yesterday, and that new edition has 57 pages of corroboration of Frank Sheeran's confessions to me. And for those who don't know in the audience, I was a professional homicide investigator. I taught interrogation to cops, and then I taught cross-examination, a related art, to trial lawyers. And I was a very successful trial lawyer cross-examining neurosurgeons and other expert witnesses. After having been an investigator of homicides. And I wrote a book called The Right to Remain Silent on my investigations of homicides. That came out in 1988. And so when I began interrogating Frank Sheeran in 1999 and had him to myself for close to 5 years, I obtained from him serial confession after confession. Well, just yesterday, my publisher put out a new edition of the book. And in order to tell the difference between the new edition and the old, there's a yellow blurb on it. They call it a burst. It's a sunburst that says that this is going to be a major motion picture directed by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, it's real exciting. You also got Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, maybe the two greatest actors, particularly in this genre, this. It's got to be exciting for you, right, after all this time and, you know, even getting people to buy in and all this work you've put into your life in this, to actually see it on the screen and see it being done by the best in the business.
Well, the real reward was when the new edition came out with 57 pages that I had held back, because the mafia bosses were still alive and active. And since then, they have died or gone to prison, or in one important case, become a cooperating witness for the FBI. And after that gentleman became a cooperating witness for the FBI then took seriously my book, I Heard You Paint Houses, and immediately subpoenaed my tapes, because my interviews with Frank Sheeran, the mafia hitman, He was a hitman for both the most powerful mafia boss in America, Russell Bufalino, a man who had, believe it or not, final script approval of the Godfather movie. And he was also a hitman for Jimmy Hoffa. And the FBI subpoenaed my tapes after Billy D'Elia became a cooperating witness. And when they asked him what happened to Hoffa, he told them to read my book, even though Billy didn't like me and didn't trust me.
And, you know, what I find fascinating, people hear your last name, Brandt, and they don't realize that actually you're the grandson of Italian immigrants like me, come from that stock. Did you find, kind of as you did this thing, almost a determination to get to the truth? Because I know a lot of Italian people that came, from the old country and so forth, and they, quite frankly, are offended constantly at being associated with the mob and so forth. And while they knew that went on, it was one of those things where they wanted to clarify what exactly went on and how this was kind of the small sect of this whole group that came into the country. Were you kind of driven by that at all, Charles?
I truly was. In fact, my grandparents, Rosa and Luigi DiMarco, have been the influence of my entire life. They were people who, in Italy, could never own land because of the system they had over there, and they came to America with the dream of owning land. They had a little family farm in Staten Island. My grandfather had a horse and wagon, and he would peddle the produce from that farm to the Americans who came to New Dorp Beach in Staten Island for the summer. And we were what I refer to as Perry Como Italians, as opposed to, you know, those gangsters that gave us all a bad name.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, in connection with your question, in addition to this book, I heard you paint houses with its 57 pages, the new edition of it. In the past, I wrote a book with the real Donnie Brasco, Joe Pistone, the wrecking ball of the American Mafia, called Donnie Brasco, Unfinished Business. And I wrote a book with another paisan, Supervisor Lynn DeVecchio, whose mafia commission case under Rudy Giuliani, another paisan, put the mafia out of business by going after the heads of the families and convicting them and sending them to jail for 100 years. No one with any sense wanted to be a boss anymore. And so the old-fashioned Don Corleone type gave way to the really incompetent nut, John Gotti type.
Yeah.
And that brought the end to the unbelievable power and influence that the mafia had. When I told you that Russell Bufalino had final script approval, I learned that from the producer's wife. I was giving a talk, and I mentioned how my friend Al Martino, the late Al Martino, the singer,
right,
who appears as Johnny Fontaine in the Godfather trilogy. He's the only actor that's in all three of them. Anyway, the late Al Martino shared with me how he got his part in The Godfather from his own personal godfather, Russell Bufalino, against the wishes of Francis Ford Coppola. So I spoke about that at this writers' conference. And a woman came up to me afterwards. She was the wife of Al Ruddy. Al Ruddy is the producer of the original Godfather movie. So Wanda Ruddy told me I should talk to Al about Bufalino, and she said that Bufalino had final script approval of the Godfather movie. So they were really quite powerful.
No, it's incredible stuff. And that's why people, really, you got to get this book, I Heard You Paint Houses. It's a fascinating book, and I think it's important because, for me anyway, who's been kind of interested in this stuff all my life, it's kind of a final thing that kind of brings all this stuff together. And as you mentioned, Charles, the mob as we know it from that period of time in the 20th century is changed. It's not like that anymore and so forth. And kind of, I think you kind of brought all this together between Jimmy Hoffa. You even have in there comments from Bob, we talked before about the Kennedys, Bobby Kennedy, right, regarding some of all this that went on.
Oh, definitely. And Bobby Jr. was on the Charlie Rose show not too long ago saying that his father gave lip service to the Warren Commission report but thought it was a shoddy piece of craftsmanship, but that his father believed that the mob killed Kennedy. And the book, which you can now, just to make sure the audience buys the most updated version, or if they own the old version, they go out and buy the new version.
It's, yeah, because it is different. There's enough stuff where even if you have the 2004 book, am I right, Charles? These 57 pages alone are worth another purchase.
It's pretty concise stuff, and it's got a burst on it that says soon to be a major motion picture by Martin Scorsese, and this stuff includes an enormous amount of independent corroboration for the murders of Jimmy Hoffa, Crazy Joey Gallo and Umberto's Clam House in Little Italy, and the JFK assassination, all in one book. As you say, I bring it all together. So, and the corroboration is independent. For example, the corroboration on the JFK, on the mob's involvement in the JFK assassination, that comes from recently released FBI reports that were released as a result of a law allowing the public access to these FBI reports. So it's quite a trifecta. Those three homicides, the major unsolved homicides of the 20th century, all in one book.
Absolutely. And this whole idea that it came pretty much from this Frank the Irishman, Sharan. Tell us this whole thing. Why was he so important? I mean, he was just so well connected to all these things, right? That, you know, he had the access to this.
Yeah, he was incredibly connected to all these things. And he was the number one suspect of the FBI when Hoffa disappeared. He had been identified in six books as taking part in the Hoffa disappearance. He was profiled in the New York Times, profiled in Newsweek, and countless other articles. And I happened to have gotten him out of jail prematurely on medical grounds. When I mentioned earlier that my career included cross-examining neurosurgeons, I was doing medical legal work, and the Philadelphia Mafia contacted me and wanted me to spring Frank Sheeran on medical grounds. He was 70 years old, and he had severe medical problems. I did that, and he and I then began talking, and I began to realize that this wasn't just a simple thug. This was a complicated man with deep feelings. His father had studied for the priesthood for 5 years. His mother went to Mass every morning, and I had been raised Catholic. We had that in common, and I preyed upon that Catholicism of his to get serial confession after serial confession from him. Now, some of the murders, of the 25 to 30 murders that he committed, he didn't really have that much feeling about, but he had enormous feeling about Jimmy Hoffa. He idolized Hoffa, and he was put into the unenviable position of having to participate in Hoffa's murder, as the book describes in detail.
When we return, more with Charles Brandt, sharing revelations from a new edition of his New York Times bestseller, I Heard You Paint Houses, Frank the Irishman Sharan, and closing the case on Jimmy Hoffa. You are listening to America's Great Conversations on The Stephen Maggi Show.
Provocative guests, real interviews, surprising answers. This is The Stephen Maggi Show.
You'd never suspect that you could find natural beauty as part of a working landfill. You can. Today, waste management landfills provide more than 17,000 acres of protected land for wildlife habitats. Working closely with communities and the Wildlife Habitat Council, we can ensure there will be protected space for native animal and plant life to thrive. From everyday collection to environmental protection, think green. Think waste management.
You are listening to Charles Brandt, who used his interrogation skills to help solve the major homicides of Jimmy Hoffa, Crazy Joe Gallo, and President Kennedy for the book I Heard You Paint Houses. Charles and I were just talking about Hoffa's murder.
In fact, it was a murder that when people look for the body, they're totally wasting their time. Frank Sheeran said to me, if there were a body, the FBI would have had it, would have found it years ago. Hoffa was on orders of Russell Bufalino. Hoffa was cremated within an hour of his disappearance. I don't want to give away too much. I don't want to spoil the readers. But the reviews on the book have been outstanding, and it's accepted. It's just plain accepted by anyone who reads it. You know, it has the ring of truth. And you're talking to a guy who, in addition to having a successful career as a homicide investigator, having written a book about it, The Right to Remain Silent, and having written two books with mafia experts, Joe Pistone, the real Donnie Brasco, and Linda Vecchio, the Mafia Commission supervisor. In addition to those things, I was appointed by the Delaware Supreme Court to investigate lawyers who commit unethical conduct. And I did that for 13 years for no pay. And among those that I investigated was our current Vice President Joe Biden for his failure to disclose that when in law school he had they caught him cheating,
yeah,
and plagiarizing. Now I cleared him, but appropriately cleared him. I had too much of a reputation to put on the line for a book with a $20,000 advance. You know?
No, exactly. And I mean, you know, the book from 2004 was highly praised. Now people are just going incredible. You know, so we get some of these revised editions, and you usually find it in some coffee table books where there's some new stuff. They throw a few things. This really surprised me because I looked at it and it's like, wow, you know, it's a different book with those 57 pages because there's just so much more that's happening. And consequently, if anybody's read this in the 2004 book or heard about it or something, you kind of need this part because, as you said before, it ties everything together. And I guess that just comes kind of from your role, your entire life and so forth, is like to get to the bottom of things, right? I mean, that's kind of what this is about.
Thank you for saying that, because that's so true. For whatever reason that God had in mind for me, every single thing I did in my life led to this moment, where I became friends with Frank the Irishman Sheeran. I had him to myself. It wasn't just on the witness stand for an afternoon. I had them to myself for close to 5 years, and on tape. And the FBI now has my tapes.
No, and I think the important part, like you said before, is here's a dying man who's struggling with this. He's got deep faith and so forth, and this is kind of, you know, you say he's Catholic. Well, this was sort of not confessing to a priest. He's confessing to you all these different things that I guess he couldn't go to his grave without at least explaining what happened so people would know.
That's exactly what it was. In Catholicism, it's called a deathbed conversion. My wife loved to hear him say, which he said several times in her company, I don't know if there's anything after this life, but if there is, and I got a shot at it, I don't want to close the door. And so, you know, he believed in heaven and hell, and he didn't just confess to me, although the detailed confessions were to me. But after he finished the final confession on videotape, all the others were on audio tape, he received communion and confession from the local priest at the hospital, young priest, and then he refused to eat. He simply stopped eating.
Wow.
And he was dead in 6 weeks. He had gotten it all off his chest. He received the sacraments of his religion and just stopped eating. Now, I guess in his own mind, that didn't constitute a sin, failure to eat.
Yeah.
But he committed suicide by that method. I didn't know this at the time, but it's apparently what people in nursing homes do when they're tired of their lives.
I'm just thinking of this priest hearing that confession. That's not your typical confession, I gotta say.
No, he didn't get the details. He got an overall confession that he did murder people, but not the details of any of it. So, and the movie people understand it. I had a meeting with Scorsese, De Niro, and the screenwriter Steve Zalian, and I was so impressed how well they understood this man, and how much Robert De Niro wants to play him in the movie. You know, he was a guy who did nothing wrong his whole life until World War II. And in World War II, he was in Patton's killer division with the instructions not to take prisoners, the Thunderbird division. And 10 years after the war, he had a chance meeting with Russell Bufalino at a truck stop outside of Elmira, New York. And that meeting changed his life. He got brought into this way of life.
It's an incredible story. It's called I Heard You Paint Houses, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, and Closing the Case on Jimmy Hoffa. It's a great book. And Charles Brand, thank you so much for that. We look forward to the movie, but first, you got to read the book. There's nothing like it. Thanks so much for being with us, Charles. Good luck with us.
Thank you, my paisan, Steve.
When we return, you'll meet Glenn Johns, who engineered or produced iconic albums for some of the best rock acts in the business. For example, Abbey Road with the Beatles, Led Zeppelin's debut album, as well as the Eagles' debut album, Who's Next by The Who, and many others. This is The Stephen Maggi Show.
Thought-provoking questions and fascinating conversations. This is The Stephen Maggi Show.
Waste management has earth-friendly plans that fit the biggest corporations and recycling programs to help smaller companies get started. We're there for you every night and on the job with you every day. When you put waste management to work, you get an environmental partner and big ideas for every size business. From everyday collection to environmental protection, think green. Think waste management. To learn more, visit WM.com.
Chances are, if you heard the great music of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, stuff like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, The Who, Led Zeppelin, you've heard this gentleman's work. His name is Glenn Johns, and he's a producer and engineer of a lot of the rock and roll records from those great groups. And Glenn, in fact, he's a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's got a book out which covers all this fascinating stuff called Sound Man, A Life Recording Hits with Some of the Great Groups of All Times. Glenn, tell me, let's start with the Beatles, if you would. You were the guy behind the idea of doing that rooftop concert right at the end of their stuff. What happened there? What gave you that idea?
We were having lunch one day, and we didn't have an end to the what we were doing, which was initially supposed to be a live concert, which was to be recorded for a TV show and also for an album of all new material. And that idea had dissipated somewhat during the process of the rehearsal of the songs. So we had a documentary film being made about something that had no end at that particular moment. So we were having lunch one day, and Ringo asked me if I had seen the roof of the building before, if I'd ever been up there, because he thought the view from there was particularly interesting. So he took me up there, and to be honest with you, I'm not absolutely certain that it wasn't both of our ideas. I don't know that I can take complete credit, but anyway, as a result of that, us going up there, we came up with the idea of possibly the band playing up there, and therefore playing to the whole of the West End of London, which we thought was rather a novel and amusing idea.
No, it was a great idea.
We put it to everyone else, and they agreed, so we did it.
No, it's a great idea, and it kind of was the precursor to the whole MTV thing. I mean, that was, in my mind, one of the really first music videos that were out.
Okay.
Yeah, well, let me...
It certainly wasn't intended to be that. It was supposed to be for another purpose, but there we are. Things happen.
Well, talk about things happening. At that time, the Beatles were in a mess. That was right before they broke up. A lot of people blame Yoko Ono. You were there, watched John and Yoko together. Was that the defining end of that group?
No. Listen, the band broke up a long time after those sessions. They made Abbey Road after that. Mm-hmm. So the idea that anything that happened on those sessions influenced them breaking up. What happened on those sessions was a blip. It was a disagreement. I wasn't in the room, and we all left the room when we saw there was a disagreement happening to give the guys the privacy they clearly deserved. So we weren't party to what went on, and I know no more than that, and I think I state that quite clearly in the book. So, and as far as Yoko is concerned, as I have no idea what happens in private conversations with anybody, I have absolutely no idea. And to be honest with you, I don't think that it really matters.
Yeah.
Particularly because nobody really knows. So why speculate about it?
No, I mean, was it just, do you think it's just a time where, you know, they had done everything you could do? I mean, you know, they'd kind of broken. It was time for them to go out on their own and try some different things individually?
Well, that seemed to be the case, as the way it turned out. And the fact is, they, like any group of people, they've been together for a long time, possibly... Listen, this isn't my opinion even, I'm just speculating. Each of them had their own idea about of what they wanted to do musically, and perhaps it didn't necessarily correlate with each other. And that happens in every band I've ever worked with, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
It's bound to happen. It happens in relationships, it happens in the workplace. People have disagreements, and they resolve them or they don't, and people move on. And that's, in a creative environment, that's sort of enlarged somewhat, really. because you're not just talking about personal relationships, you're talking about creativity and what you want to achieve as an artist.
Well, and you,
sometimes it can be done as a group, and sometimes it's better if you bugger off and do it on your own.
Glenn, tell us, is it one of those things where there has to be somebody that can hold those groups together? Because I think of like The Who, you know, they had volatile personalities and so forth, yet they've managed off and on to still be around, you know, 50 years later.
You're absolutely correct. Of course, there are volatile members, or there were when all four of them were still alive. However, to the best of my knowledge, and certainly in my experience, there was never a split second when there was any talk of them splitting up. And I think possibly the volatileness of the individuals perhaps fed the engine of what they were doing to a degree. I think it became sort of a bit of a habit that they kind of relied on to do what they were doing. So they put it to good use. Without any question, because what they achieved was pretty remarkable, really.
I want you to talk a little about the first time you saw Led Zeppelin. I know you were blown away by them and actually tried to get Mick Jagger and George Harrison to listen and so forth, and they weren't particularly as impressed, but obviously history has shown that at least a lot of people think that you were right about Led Zeppelin.
Well, exactly right. And what that proved to me was that although at that moment in time, I assumed rather foolishly that all us lot that had been in the business for as long as we had and knew each other and were working with each other had similar tastes. And of course, that's obviously not the case. Nobody has, everybody's taste differs in some to some degree. Otherwise, the world wouldn't go round.
Yeah. Well, you know, and as you as an engineer and stuff, then did you find, Glenn, that, you know, depending on what particular style people had and so forth, was it important that you had that kind of understanding and that agreement to really put these great sounds out, or is it just something where you listen to them and put out whatever they need? I mean, I know it's kind of a naive question, but...
No, I don't think it's a naive question at all. I think it's a very good question. The fact of the matter is that no two artists I've worked with have had precisely the same requirements, particularly as a producer. And my whole role... As individually, I'm not talking about producers in general, but because I'm an engineer as well, is to try and represent whatever the act is giving to me as best as possible sonically. And obviously the material recorded, the emotive content of the material recorded, et cetera, would require a slightly different approach sonically from me. But more to the point, it is... Whatever they are delivering to me in the studio is the sound I'm trying to capture. It's the sound of the individual or collectively all of them that they are creating that made them as original as they were or are still to this day. And the challenge for me was to try and represent what they were doing as best as possible and as accurately as possible while not doing the material any disservice in the process.
Fine.
That job varied from one artist to another, and like I say, sometimes you were encouraged to help out a little bit more than with others. That's what makes the process so fascinating, and that's why every time I've walked into a studio, and certainly the next time I walk into a studio, I'm going to learn something.
This book has got incredible stories like that. People, you're going to love it. The process is called Sound Man. One last question for you, Glenn, before we have to let you go. You almost were part of putting together an incredible collaborative event with, you know, you ran into Bob Dylan, and you can explain this at the airport. You talked about working on an album with him, the Stones, and the Beatles, but it never came to pass. But how close did we actually get to that, Glenn?
Oh, it didn't get close at all. It was Bob Dylan's idea, and he asked me, having just met me, if I could facilitate, or at least ask the Beatles and the Stones if they would be at all interested in making an album with everybody, with all three acts on the same record, a collaborative record. And it astounded me when he came up with the idea. It was a pretty off-the-wall idea, as you can imagine, but because they were the three greatest influences on music in the previous decade, it would have been an astonishing achievement if they'd have done something together. Clearly, it didn't come off because some of the others weren't interested in doing it, which is, and they were, I'm sure they were right. It could have been a complete train wreck. but I'd love to have given it a go, I can tell you.
The book is Sound Man Glenn. Is there a place on the web or something we can find out more about this great book?
Yes, glennjohns.com.
We will go there. Glenn, thank you so much. Really enjoyed chatting with you today.
Well, just buy the book.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And then we might want
to
read more.
Just go and buy it. Hopefully you'll enjoy it.
I'm sure we will. Glenn, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
When we return, you'll hear from John W. Dean, a key player in the Nixon administration, who divulges the full and complete story of Nixon's role in Watergate in his book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. You're listening to The Stephen Maggi Show. Don't forget to mark your calendars for October 1st. That's the day this show becomes Vegas Never Sleeps. In it, I'll be covering everything Vegas, including the stars, the restaurants, the special events, the history, and more of this internationally known entertainment capital. If you've visited, you'll understand, and if you haven't, you'll get a taste of what you've missed.
You're listening to Stephen Maggi, host of one of America's top interview programs, The Stephen Maggi Show.
Dear Daddy, dear Mom,
I love you.
I miss you.
Every year, Snowball Express honors the children of fallen soldiers. Hi, everybody. I'm Tony Orlando. Join me in proudly supporting Snowball Express, a nonprofit that creates opportunities to help heal the children of our fallen heroes. We can never repay the sacrifice our soldiers have made, but we can honor them by giving back to their children. Donate now at snowballexpress.org.
What would you do if you weren't afraid? What would you do if you knew that you couldn't fail? My name is Logan Reed, and I'm a PCC credentialed life coach, working with people every day who want to know the answers to these questions for themselves and then make it happen. I work with people who are ready to take charge of their life, to leave their unsatisfying job and launch a new career, have the romantic relationship of their dreams, prepare for retirement, experience more joy. I partner with clients to support them in getting clear on what they truly want in life, creating the plan to get there, and taking the action to make it all come to life. If you would like to explore how working together can make your dream life a reality, I invite you to give me a call at 360-529-1848 or write me at Logan@LoganReedCoaching.com. Want to learn more about who I am and what coaching is? Check out my website at www.LoganReedCoaching.com. I look forward to meeting you.
Well, it's 40 years ago, the only president of the United States to resign, Richard Nixon, did that. And, of course, it all was around the Watergate scandal, which was a huge and still is a huge part of politics today. And with us is the former legal counsel to President Nixon and a key player in that, John W. Dean. He's got a book that brings everything together, really a must for history buffs and so forth to really figure out what's going on. It's called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. John, I have to ask you, was it kind of a relief for you to be able to take all this new information from tapes and so forth, and you could talk a little about where you got all this, to finally put this together and answer all the questions that everybody has?
It has been, and it's been pleased. I've really been pleased that historians like Robert Dalek, writing for the New York Times, another presidential historian, said, you know, this is the definitive account. Bob Woodward, who covered this story for the Washington Post, and it made his career, came out and said, I'd put a microscope on that presidency and answered all the questions. So, yes, it has been satisfying for me personally because that's what provoked my interest in doing the book. I wanted to understand how somebody as savvy as Richard Nixon, very sophisticated politically, let a bungled burglary implode his presidency. And I have the answers now.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got it from a number of places. Some of the tapes that we've been waiting for, I know from the Nixon Library. Talk about some of the the background that you took to finally put all this together?
Yeah, it was a remarkable undertaking. I suspect had I known going in what was involved, I might have been really reluctant to do it. But once I slowly got into it, I realized what I had to do, and I was probably the best person to do it. I first cataloged all the Watergate conversations because that had never been done, and that's done by the National Archives keeps a subject log on each conversation. And in fact, I dedicate the book to the archives, given the remarkable work they've done over the last four decades in dealing with this material, because it's hard to deal with. It's hard to hear. It's time-consuming, and while technology is getting better, when they started, it was really rough. But anyway, they list all the people who will come up in the conversation. Then they don't do transcripts, but they will put the gist of what was said down. Say, take Kissinger. He might be talking about Vietnam, Paris peace talks, Ambassador Bunker, you know, all kinds. They get these headings. So what I did is I went through all the subject logs, and from the subject logs, I withdrew all the conversations that related to Watergate. And that could be a fleeting conversation that could last just a minute or so, to consuming conversations that went on for hours that were nothing but Watergate. So there are a thousand of those, and they, as I say, they vary from quick to protracted. And then I looked to see who, if anybody, had transcribed any of these conversations. Found the Watergate prosecutor had done about 80 of them. About 12 of them were good. The rest of them were just FBI secretary first drafts and not very good. They didn't even have the right person often identified who was talking. So those had to be redone. And then I looked at the work of Stanley Cutler, a historian who got the archives to release these things earlier than Nixon wanted them. And Stanley did a good job. The thing is, Stanley had a space problem, and often his transcripts will have ellipses in them, and that could be 20, 30, 40 minutes of material I thought was very interesting and valuable. And plus, he's had to be selective. He did 320 conversations, so he left on the floor an awful lot of that. Some weren't available, but even those that were available. Another thing that happened is, as people have died, personal material that was withdrawn has been put back by the archives. So I really did them all from start, is what it ended up being. And I got a team of grad students who helped me. I had one woman who was a former legal secretary who is now completing her PhD in archival science, who did 500 conversations. She was remarkable. The other students did about 250, and I did about 250. I tended to work on the drafts where somebody had already done them, and I would go through and check the drafts because I was also able, through technology, to digitize. I was way in front of the archives in digitizing a lot of these. They actually have better digital copies now because they had better masters to go back to than they passed out, or I was able to digitize their available reference copy.
Well, you know, as a young lawyer, John, you must have been shocked to see what went on in the executive office. And then as you go back through this, is it even like, it's still, when you see this, are you amazed that this was going on?
I'm not totally amazed, but I am stunned at Nixon's behavior at times. I thought he was a much more careful decision maker. There are things I had no idea he was involved in, from suborning perjury that was essential to make the initial cover-up work, to personally raising money for the Watergate defendants. He took that on, and it was indeed, both before and after, I'd made it very clear to him that's obstruction of justice. So there's not a page of the book that really doesn't have something that surprises me, because even my own conversations, I had only seen transcripts of some of them, and you hear a conversation, and I try to capture that in the writing, because I'm not doing a book of transcripts, they're a book of narrative and dialogue. And so I'm able to explain, put a little context in, and explain what they sounded like when many of these things were said. So the full picture, I think, is much different than I had envisioned it.
do you think this has kind of changed the way we do politics? I mean, I think there's no question now you see all these different scandals, regardless of party in the White House. And it seems to me that because of what this book tells a story of, people now can believe this can happen. So consequently, when things get out, people are looking for smoking guns and that kind of thing, because you can see kind of the way your story tells where it's all connected to other stuff there. I mean, do you think that's something that we're going to live with from now on?
Well, it's certainly we should have a better understanding of this history, because we have a tendency to repeat our history because we ignore it. One of my hopes is, first, that those who live through it can get the answer to the question they couldn't get before, and those who this is all new might hopefully take a look at it to avoid repeating it. And because this is Watergate really became a nonpartisan scandal. By the time Nixon leaves, over 80% of the American people agree with his decision to resign. And that, when can you get 80% of America to agree upon anything?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the book is an incredible story. It's called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. And, John, I assume that's everywhere and everybody's going to be reading it.
It is everywhere, and I hope everyone does read it.
Thanks for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's show. Remember to check out our website, StephenMaggiShow.com. It's there that we archive all the old shows so you never miss a thing. This is The Stephen Maggi Show.
Visit us at Stephen with a V, MaggiShow.com. This is The Stephen Maggi Show.